The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Again, and actually cleared up today. Blue sky, puffy clouds, no chemtrail spraying out here. And how is it down there in Hernando's Hideaway?
87 degrees, blue sky, sun was up.
The sun was up, now yeah. It's down.
True.
It does that every damn day.
If I wasn't at work, I'd be out driving my Corvette around with the T-tops off.
But well,
nobody ever accused me of being smart.
Do you remember? Of course you remember that song, Hernando's Hideaway.
Oh, sure.
Nobody, very few people do. But you have a certain affinity for that name, I understand.
I know a dark, secluded place where no one knows your face. Archie Blyer was the band leader.
Oh, wow. Good job.
That came from the movie Pajama Game with Rock Hudson and Doris Day.
Rock Hudson, a man's man, if there ever was one.
Yeah, right.
Rock was just ahead of his time. That's all. But he was a very delightful screen presence, always fun, or good. He was a good actor.
Oh, yeah. He came from pretty close to where I grew up. Out in the northwestern suburbs of Chicago. He came from, I think it was Evanston, Illinois. There were a lot of people. Paul Lynn came from that area.
Huh.
What's his name? The guy that played the father on Happy Days. Can't remember his name. Ann Margaret. She was born in Sweden, but she grew up in Ingleside, which is a suburb. It's next to Fox Lake, which is 45 miles northwest of the city. That's where I was living on my boat in summers when the office manager at the marina didn't like me because I had naked girls on my boat all the time. So I got even with her. I married her at the end of the year, and it was 33 years ago.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me? Is that what you, are you telling me? That Kay was the. Wait a minute. What are you telling me?
She was the office manager at the marina where I lived on my boat summers. After I'd spent almost 8 years living on my boat in the Bahamas.
Is this the same boat?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You had it trailered up.
Right. I had it trucked up to Fox Lake, which is where I built it. I built it right there at that marina and sailed off down the Chicago River, the Des Plaines River, the Fox River, the Illinois River, the Mississippi, and out across the Gulf, et cetera, and into the down to the Bahamas. That was a great time.
What a mariner. That's not easy.
I didn't even know how to sail when I got the boat. I put an ad in Cruising World magazine for female crew slash companion. Got over 200 replies, left with a blonde, a brunette, and a redhead that were 24, 24, and 25 years old, and I was 40. One of them, fortunately, Debbie, she was an excellent sailor. And like I said, I lived almost 8 years in the Florida Keys and in the Bahamas.
Can you imagine if you ran an ad now, what you'd get?
Yeah, the Me Too guys would be out there and all sorts of loonies.
Oh, man. That's really an absolutely unique and extraordinary life that you have.
Yeah, that was in the 70s. That's the way life was in the 70s.
Yeah.
But then, like I said, I had a truck back up there in summers. I was living on the boat in summer of 1985. My buddy John Watts, who owns the marina, hired this new gal for the office manager. And every Monday or so, the talk around the so-called yacht club was how many naked broads did Cooper have on his boat for the weekend. And the secretary, the office manager, she didn't like me at all. And then at the end of the summer, she asked me if I would take her for a ride on my speedboat. Okay, my buddy's office manager, both hands on the wheel. And that's the chain of lakes up there, and it's in the Guinness Book of World Records for the most bars per mile of shoreline. And I used to drink in those days, so we'd stop at this bar and go to the next bar, and by afternoon we were getting along real well, and 2 weeks later we were married.
I don't understand how she could forgive all the debauchery that she was aware of.
Well, yeah, but she and I weren't together at that time.
I understand. But women remember things.
I imagine. Maybe she thought she could reform me. Apparently it worked. And as you know, that was 1 year after my 20-year-old son was killed.
And
It got my head screwed on straight. We got 2 years later, we had Sean, who's special needs, and he's the most incredible young man. And then almost 4 years later, we had Megan, who's just about to turn 28.
Oh, and come on. She was just 21 a few years ago, or 22.
Yeah, every year you get 1 year older, I guess. It's just the way it works out that way.
Great stuff. Great story. And what a remarkable juxtaposition from office manager and that damn Cooper, that louse, that drunk, that womanizer.
Yeah, I was that way back in those days, but you had to be around in the 70s to understand that's the way it was.
That's exactly right.
AIDS had not popped up yet.
Uh-uh. Wasn't even sown into the population until 1976.
Right, and most of the young women were on the pill, and everybody was out for a good time. Nobody was getting seduced. Everybody was going to the discos with the expectation of hooking up, and that's the way it was. And you tell some of these younger people that, they're all shocked and appalled. Oh, God, that's terrible. That's horrible. Well, no, by today's standards, maybe it is, but by the standards in force at the time, that was what everybody did.
Wow. Well, whatever happened to your yacht?
Obama.
Oh.
Unfortunately, when the economy went in the toilet, thanks to the plague named Obama, hit our country, I couldn't afford the dock rentals, and I was trying to make arrangements with the marina, and they said nope. And they auctioned it off. And it sold for $1.
Come on.
A 30-foot, ready-to-go ocean sailing yacht. Obviously, the auction was not well advertised. I think, the marina owner mentioned it to his buddy. Hey, come on over. That's just as well.
Well,
we lived on that K&I after we got married. We spent summers living on the boat up there. Obviously, you can't live on a boat in Chicago in the wintertime, but the summers we lived on it up there. And we brought it down here in 1987. We lived on it until Sean was born. We lived on it in a real nice liveaboard marina down in North Fort Myers. Mm-hmm. And Sean was born in Fort Myers. But then my wife decided he needed a swing. He needed a playpen. He needed this. He needed that. And it doesn't fit on a 30-foot boat.
Uh-huh.
So the three of us plus our big chocolate lab named Mutsy, we swallowed the anchor, and that was the ball game.
I haven't heard that expression before.
Swallowed the anchor means if you're a liveaboard yachtie and you sell and quit, you swallow the anchor. The same when I quit driving race cars, you hung up the helmet.
That I've heard.
Okay.
Now, we have another issue to explore. This is fun with Cooper Knight. Now, Harry and Kay have a very nice looking trailer. What do we call that? This is a trailer.
It's
mobile.
It's an RV.
There you go. And you tow it.
RV.
Harry got the truck deal of a lifetime. Great truck.
Yeah.
And he's got a ball hitch on it. You simply hook up the RV to the back of the truck. No problem, right? None.
And when you get out, instead of a hand crank to raise and lower the tongue, it's got a little push button motor on it.
Very smart. Now, this little, for all of you who know this, when you hook up to the back of a truck or whatever, when you park the thing, you need to get the tongue up off the ground, the connecting bar.
Mm-hmm.
So you used to have to crank it up by hand. Well, this one is really slick. It's got an automatic little motor that cranks the tongue up off the ground. Can take it up about, looks like 3 feet to a maximum.
It's supposed to only take it up a couple inches so you can drive the truck out from under it.
Well, now tell us the story, and I've seen the picture, but this is crazy. This is crazy incompetence. I cannot believe the company that made this item is still in business at all.
Well, they're still in business, all right. I don't even know the name of the company, so I can't mention it.
The Tel Aviv Young Tongue Company or something.
No, I think it's called Lippert. That's what it is, Lippert, or something like that. But anyhow, like as you know, when I got up Sunday morning and looked out, there was my travel trailer, 30-foot-long travel trailer. It looked like a funny car doing a wheelie because in the night, Saturday night, Sunday morning, sometime in the dark, the motor decided to turn itself on, and it extended the foot.
It's the vertical bar, right? That gets it's like a round pipe that goes down, and there's a foot on it, and that's what it sits on. Well, this motor went off, and the tongue started to climb up higher and higher on this pipe.
Yep.
Up. And I
got up to maximum, which is about 4 feet off the ground.
It's unbelievable.
And froze. It crushed the rear stabilizers, and it looked like a praying mantis. But I went down to the dealer. They gave me a brand new tongue motor rod, whatever the hell that thing is, and told me, okay, here, it's warranty. I said, good. How do I get the trailer in here for you to put it on? Oh, no, Mr. Cooper. You put it on, because you can't hook up with it like that. So I had a couple guys come over today, and it took us a half an hour, that was all, and zing, bang, boom.
Yeah, but here's the deal that Harry hasn't mentioned yet. This company has had a number of potentially catastrophic failures when the motor goes off on its own and the tongue starts to climb higher and higher and higher. That's the tongue. That's the part that, for those of you who don't know, that is connected to the trailer that moves forward, and you attach that to the ball hitch on your truck. It's like a big round arm that sticks straight out. Anyway, this thing, if you're driving down the road and this thing decides to go off on you, what happens?
Thank God it didn't happen to me, but from what I understand from the service manager, it has happened to others. It's got to be one hell of a shocker. You're chugging down the highway at 60, 70 miles an hour, and suddenly the tail end of your truck starts going up and up and up, and you hear this horrendous screeching as the lift goes down and hits the pavement. sparks will be flying. Oh, you know, if somebody had it on a dash cam, you'd make YouTube for sure.
I just don't understand how this can happen. That's really, and it's not something that is unknown. It's happened apparently a number of times.
Power tongue lift is what it's called. Probably made in China, like all the rest of the crap that doesn't work. We're not the only ones stuck with Chinese-made crap. Every place I go, you know, I go to Europe a lot, and I go to South America a lot. Made in China is everywhere. That's why their military is building up so fast.
Well, we're going to also get the Chinese model social credit system. It's coming, and it will be here very soon. And I don't know if you know about it yet or not. Do you?
No.
Okay. You and I and all Americans, I don't know what age they're going to start, probably 12, who knows, will get a card. This card will be a digital card, and anyone can use your card, and they'll swipe it, and they'll see what your social credit score is. Not your financial capital credit score rating, your social credit. In other words, they're going to use what we commonly refer to as a credit rating in a social sense, which will evaluate you on your politics, your lifestyle, where you live, where you go, what you buy, what you think, what you say, your emails, social media, you name it. It's all going to be processed. You will get a score, a social credit score, right? And that will determine your status in society. In China, they're using these social credit scores now to determine if people will be allowed to buy airplane tickets, train tickets, and fuel. If your social credit score is down, you're toast in China.
You gotta walk, huh?
And that's what's coming here. We're going to get social credit cards, scorecards. You will have a rating. I mean, I'm in deep trouble already. I haven't even gotten the damn thing.
You're more than 12 years old, too, though.
Next year, 12.
And I'm a whole bunch more than 12 years old.
But this is coming. It's not a joke.
Ocasio-Cortez. It must be another one of her wet dreams.
No, it's already in practice in China. They're bringing it. It's a globalist thing. They want to extend it all over the Western world. Ocasio has no brains. She couldn't come up with an idea like this.
Wonder if maybe she's very smart and she's a Republican in disguise to screw up the Democrats?
That's pretty funny.
No, I don't think so. I think she's just a brain dead.
No, she's a twit. A twit. All right. Speaking of our program tonight, which we aren't, but we're going to now, we are going to go on a little photo journey with Harry, as we always do, and I hope all of you are ready. The photo link is right under his name in guests@rents.com. So go over there, and if you're not, go over it right now, click on photos, and the page will open up for you. They're all thumbnails. They're small. All you have to do is click on them. And I had my webmaster make them a third bigger. So the pictures, when they enlarge, are much larger. Isn't that a play on words? Than they usually are. So it's better. You can see more, and it's kind of jumps right out at you. All right. Are you ready?
Ready, set, go.
Okay. Number one.
Number one.
It's a good place to start, huh?
Yeah, they're always good to start at number one. Friday, Labor Day Friday, 1954, my mom and sister and I drove down into the Chicago Loop to pick up Dad from work. He worked on the north side of the Loop in the Gold Coast area, and we were going to go to Granddad's farm in southwestern Michigan, so we had to go down Lakeshore. There was no interstates in them days. Mm-hmm. Go down Lakeshore Drive and around the end of Lake Michigan and up into Berrien County where Granddad's farm was. And we're driving along, and the sign you see there, drive safely, submarine crossing, that was at the side of Lakeshore Drive, and I'm thinking, what the hell is that? I'm just turning 15 years old. So anyhow, we go on down, and that had to do with U-505. Now let's step back into time for a second here and go to A-2 through A-8.
Okay, so we got...
All those are pictures of the submarine during the war off the South American coast. It was off the mouth of the Rio Orinoco. And you can see the damage the sub took.
Let's look at A-2 first, the next picture,
yeah, A-2. A-2, the back of the conning tower is blown out, and you see a huge hole in the deck, not in the pressure hull, but the overdeck was all blown away.
So the overdeck is not connected to the pressure hull, and the overdeck is made of wood, or what?
Right, with metal metal supports and things, yeah.
Uh-huh,
and the back of the conning tower, of course, that's all steel, but it's not part of the pressure hull. There's a tube in there that is the pressure, but it damaged the pressurized part of the conning tower, too, which can be blocked off from the inside of the sub.
What the hell happened? Is this a bomb?
They got bombed. They got bombed. There were two fighter bombers, I think they were RAF, down off of the South American coast. And one pilot, I guess it was two-man aircraft, and there were two of them. One guy was too low when he dropped his bombs, and when his bomb went off, it just blew his plane apart. He died.
Him and, no kidding.
Yeah.
That's about the dumbest thing I've heard.
Yeah, it happened more than once in the war.
Wow.
So then in A3, you get a better view of the overdeck there, pretty well scattered.
That's incredible, that picture.
Yeah.
Now all the men up on the conning tower, just hanging out because the weather's nice, I guess.
Also because they couldn't dive.
So the boat, okay, the damage to the boat is the overdeck, which you see there. It's blown. It's blown to hell. The bomb looks like it went off right next to the sub.
Well, one of them hit right into the sub. We'll see that picture in a moment. Let's click on over. Forget about A4 because that's A2 all over again. Duh.
Okay.
Go to 5.
All right. A5.
And that is, now they had spare torpedoes in watertight containers underneath the wooden deck. And this is half a torpedo. The bomb hit there and blew up right on the torpedo. Fortunately for the guys on the sub, it blew off the stern of it, the back end of it, which is the propulsion end. If it would have had a few feet further forward, it would have hit, you know, the torpex. That's 350 pounds of high explosive. That would have been the end of the submarine.
That's astonishing. Look at that. It blew the side out.
Yeah.
And half of the torpedo. Why is the water waving up like that in the background? What's the deal with that?
Well, because the piece of the side was blown out.
Not the
pressure hull.
Yeah. But what's causing that big wave and white water in the background?
Well, probably the sub going through the water at its wake.
Yeah. That's an amazing picture.
Yeah. We keep looking at them. And this, I'll tell you why in a minute. Number 6 just shows you more of the destruction.
Wow.
And they finally got it patched.
Are those, excuse me, Harry, are those torpedoes there on the right and then one in the center? Round?
Not the one in the center, but the two on the right. Yes, those are torpedoes that were in the the storage underneath the deck, which the deck doesn't exist anymore. The item in the center is a covering over where the I think that's where the exhaust came out.
Huh. This is incredible.
Yeah.
So one plane blew up, the other one hit, and obviously he flew away.
Yeah.
Was the sub returning fire? Did they have a deck gun?
They had deck guns, but the deck guns on these submarines were notoriously failing because they spent their time underwater. They got all corroded and everything. And I don't know if the boat returned fire or not, but the the bombs all hit on or around the sub, even from the plane that blew itself up, because it was just too low when it came down. And you look at A7, that's a much better look of the at the damage.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And again, that round item, center leftish, that's an exhaust port, perhaps?
Oh, no, that round thing sticking up, that's not an exhaust port. I think that's an intake.
Uh-huh. Okay. And again, the pressure hull was not breached.
Correct.
Somehow.
Otherwise, it wouldn't be with us.
No.
So, and then the last one is A8, just another hull. Now, the one thing about this, well, A8 is the same as A5. Boy, oh boy, what a dummy I am here. Anyhow, U-505 was the most heavily damaged submarine in World War II to ever make it back home in one piece. They limped all the way back home to Lorient. They were, they were in the second U-boat flotilla, which was Lorient. And then began a long series of layovers in their home port, which we'll talk about in a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Then if you go to A9, after we saw the sign that says danger submarine crossing, we got further down, and this is what we saw on the shore of Lake Michigan.
Wow.
A submarine getting ready to be hauled across Lakeshore Drive. And I remember thinking, who the hell would want this thing? Well, now I know. It's a priceless piece of history. It's the first ever enemy man-of-war boarded on the high seas and captured in combat by the U.S. Navy since the War of 1812.
So the pictures of the damaged sub were before it was captured. It was captured in a... No, it went back to port and got fixed.
That's correct. It got captured on the 4th of June, 1944.
Okay.
So it got repaired. And then A-10 shows you when it first got moved to the Museum of Science and Industry. It's been moved several times since then, and it's inside its own little bunker-like compartment now. But
A-10, look at that.
Yeah.
Strange they took the markings off of it. There are two AA guns. There's a twin, looks like a twin, and
that's
then a single.
Twin 20.
Yeah.
Twin 20, and then on the Winter Garden, or the after bandstand, as the U.S. called it, that's their 3.7 or their 37 millimeter. That's been restored quite beautifully.
This is really amazing.
Now to the interesting story that people don't know. And I got this from Peter Hansen. You know, he's member number 251 of Shark Hunters, and we're up to 8,200 and something. He was a lieutenant, Leutnant C, which is like our lieutenant junior grade. But he got wounded twice. It wasn't so bad. The third time he got wounded was too bad for him to go out to sea again. So they made him a naval investigator. And it turns out, and I just got this in a letter from him a couple days ago, there was one hell of a black market group on board U-505. They were selling uniform parts. They were selling equipment. You know, the black market, you see stuff like that in McHale's Navy and stuff like that. And it did go on during the war, but it wasn't supposed to.
They were selling it to whom? Other German naval?
Depending what they were selling to. They were selling to the locals, too. But they were also, you know, and everybody was making torpedo cocktails. They would take the alcohol out of their torpedoes because the alcohol, they were alcohol-powered. They had a little motor in them. That's what left the bubbles behind them until they went to the electric weightless torpedoes. They were taking the alcohol out of the torpedoes and making torpedo cocktails, mixing it with whatever and selling it to other people. They also had a still going because the submarine U-505 was one of the least deployed submarines after she came back to get repaired, because that was when the sabotage started in the French, with the French dockyard workers. They went out one time and found out that somebody had sprinkled iron filings into the electric motors, which of course finished off the electric motors. Or another time, they were traveling underwater, and yet an airplane kept dropping bombs right over them, and they couldn't figure out why. Well, after the airplane went away, they came back up and found out some dockyard worker had drilled a small little, maybe a quarter-inch hole in the top of the fuel bunker and filled it with some kind of putty. But once the sub got underwater, the putty went away, and it was leaking a trail of fuel oil, which was like an arrow pointing right where the submarine should be.
Lots of
sabotage. So anyhow, these guys, there were about eight of them, according to Peter, and one of them, we didn't know all this. One of them, you'll see the picture there.
What picture are we on? I'm looking at 11.
A12.
All right, hold on. Let's go back to A11. What's this?
Oh, okay, sorry. A11. That when the submarine was about to be captured by the U.S. Navy, USS Guadalcanal Task Force, the carrier and five destroyer escorts, the sea strainer cap here was removed, and this is a strainer they can take out. It's in the in the cooling water system for the water coming in from the outside, cooling the diesels and going back out. They took off the cap, and they also opened the valve to the ocean to where the water was bubbling up through here, so they were going to scuttle the boat.
Mm.
And the cap laying, the lid laying on the deck right beside it, that gets to be very important.
Okay.
As you'll see in a moment.
Right.
Then A12. We go to number 12, A12. That's a guy named Hans Gobler, who has earned the nickname of the Weasel. He was one of the black market people. And I met him in 1982. And he became member number 3 in Shark Hunters. And like I say, we're up to 82, almost 8,300. He was member number 3.
Mm-hmm.
I met him in 1982 in Chicago. He put together about probably the first ever reunion between former enemies of the war. He got a bunch of the crew from U-505 to come over to Chicago, where the submarine is, and a bunch of the U.S. Navy guys from the Guadalcanal Task Force. And they had a big reunion, and it was very successful. Bless his heart for that. He did that really well. So I met him. He led me to believe he was the first watch officer, or in other words, the executive officer of the boat.
Uh-huh.
So we got to talking later on, and I said, hey, I looked up the crew list, and it shows somebody else as the first watch officer. Oh, yeah, he said, I was mistaken. He said, I was really the Centrale mate, the chief petty officer in the central control room. In fact, he was nothing but seaman second class, which is one level above a boot. He claimed that he pulled the sea strainer off the cover. There he is in picture number 13. Later on, when he was with us, before we found any of this stuff out, he's holding the sea strainer cover in his hand, claiming he pulled the plug on it. And we found out later, I got a letter from the chief of the boat, and he said, no, the sea strainer lid was removed by engineering officer Hauser and assisted by engineering petty officer Hollenried. So Hans had nothing to do with it, but that was his claim to fame. Then he and his wife came down here to visit, and they liked the area so much, they bought a house a half a mile from me, and that's nice. I was over there back and forth quite a bit. One day I walked into his house, And there was a cardboard box, a shipping box, on the floor, and it had about 300 U-boat combat badges, U-boat Kriegsabzeichen. They were reproductions.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I said, what the hell is it? What's this? He said, well, you know, I was awarded the U-boat Kriegsabzeichen. I said, yeah, you were awarded one. You got 300 here, and these are all fakes, reproductions. Well, you know, I can buy others to put them on my uniform. I said, you don't even have a uniform. He was taking them to military shows and selling them as his own, buying them for about $30 each and selling them for $300 each, thereabouts. And the sad thing is, not only is he ripping people off for money, he's ripping people off for their dreams. They think they have something from the war years, and all they got is something made in Taiwan last week or something like that. So
got it.
I put it to the advisory board. Every single one of them said, kick him out, including Otto Kretschmer.
Uh-huh.
He said, I still have the letter. He said, take no half measures, Harry. Put him out immediately. So we kicked him out. And then he was telling everybody that he was the one who founded Shark Hunters, et cetera, and Mickey Mouse from there.
Wow. Once a weasel?
Yeah. The weasel.
Always a weasel.
I guess. So that's the story behind U-505. First, it was the most heavily damaged submarine in the war to ever make it back. Then it spent a whole lot of time in the repair yard. As a matter of fact, somebody had graffitied above one of the bunkers at Lorient, this is U-505 patrol area. And it apparently had a bad effect on the skipper, the second skipper, a guy named Peter Zeschk. And when they finally got out to sea, they were submerged and getting beat up pretty badly by a British destroyer. And Zesch or Czech or however, C-Z-E-S-C-H, put a gun to his head, and the skipper killed himself. So,
really? Right on board. He just had it. Couldn't
it.
Take the strain.
That's exactly the case.
Wow.
So anyhow, they had the black market thing going on in there, and then Gobler claims that was his claim to fame. He pulled the plug, but he really didn't. It was somebody else, and even if he had, he didn't do a very good job because the sub didn't sink. U.S. Navy got aboard, and a guy named Zenon Lukosius, who was also a member of Shark Hunters, found the valve, and he shut the valve off, and then he put the lid on. So Hansi was just a flash in the pan. And if you look at A-14,
mm-hmm.
that's the way the boat looks now. It's inside its own little enclosure in Chicago, made to look like it's inside of a bunker. And you go through it. We are, let's see. Oh, I'm looking closer. They've got the original markings on the conning tower. If you look at the forward part of the conning tower, you see the big X.
Yeah.
That was the emblem that the first skipper used, because his name was Axel Olaf Löwe.
Huh.
So he had the big battle axe.
I see it.
Yeah, and then there's up on the sides of the conning tower, I can't make it out, but I'm guessing that was probably the flotilla emblem. We're going to be in Chicago in June, and anybody who wants to meet up with a bunch of us there, send me an email at sharkhunters@sharkhunters.com or sharkhunters@earthlink.net, and just say you're interested, and we'll give you all the details.
Looks like it's got a nice home.
Yeah, this was a $3 million project that wound up costing $30 million, I think.
That's typical.
Yeah. And the thing that really, I'll tell you what, as born and raised in Chicago, I'm an old Chicago boy, really chaps my butt. They charge now. Used to be, everything was free there. Geez, I'm sounding like Ocasio-Cortez. Julius Rosenwald, who was the president, CEO of Sears Roebuck a million uh-huh. years ago, when Sears was a massive, huge entity, he put a ton of money into a trust fund, and the museum was living on the interest from the trust fund, plus also the different halls. One hall would be for the phone company, another one would be for a chemical company, whatever. And the corporations that were in that hall had to pay the museum to be there. So it was well sustaining.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's $20 to park your car in their lot, $20 more to walk in the door, and something to go on the submarine. I think it's $20, but if you're a veteran or a senior, it's $8 or something like that. I'm not exactly familiar with that. But and you can't just, used to be you could just go on, wander through the boat, and take off. No, now they're fast marching you through the boat. You have to be there at a certain time.
Uh-huh.
And
so it's drawing a big crowd is what you're saying.
It's drawing a big crowd, sure. And it should. And, well, I'll give you a better report after I've been on it. I haven't been on that boat in, probably 30 years.
Why is it white above the waterline?
That's a good question. It was, they were never white. They were deck gray, battleship gray.
Maybe that's primer and they're painting it or something.
Yeah, well,
doesn't
we
look
tried
like
to
it,
help them.
Mm-hmm.
Below the waterline is supposed to be red lead. We tried to help them because one time, now the lady who was head of all the guides was also a member of Shark Hunters, and she got mad at me because I tried to correct them. One of the guides, or one of our members, was through the boat and said that the guide was telling people that when the boat was captured, some of the crewmen had American money in their pocket and American cigarettes because they had put rubber boats over the side and rowed ashore and went to some little town, some little store, and bought American cigarettes. And so I wrote to the head of the museum, who, in my opinion, is bottom of a duck's foot.
Got it.
And I said, that's total fantasy, because if they're going to come in on a rubber boat, they must have had some mighty strong arms, because the closest that submarine ever was to the east coast of the United States was when it was going down the coast of Africa. This thing operated off the African coast.
Uh-huh.
And also off the South American coast. It was never close to America. And that's an old wives' tale about U-boat guys paddling ashore, buying bread and stuff in local stores, because these people loved Germany and hated America. That's all total rubbish.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote to the president, and of course he's too good to answer letters, so he has flunky number one write back and say, no, we have fact checkers. I said, well, you're fact. I spelled it F-A-T. Your fact checkers really screwed up, because this never happened. Well, the lady who was head of the guides, she quit her membership, and the museum doesn't want to talk to me anymore. When Jack Kahn was head of the museum, we had a great rapport. Everything was right with what the guides were saying,
yeah.
And we had unfettered access to the boat. We even made a video, which we're going to put up on our YouTube channel shortly, of a whole tour through the submarine without anybody interfering, because the guy who was the curator of the boat,
uh-huh,
was also a member of Shark Hunters, and he just let us have the boat. And when it was outside, and we, in that video, you'll see when we post it, you'll see some shots from above the boat. Me and Mike, who had the video camera, we went out a second floor window in a museum, and there was a piece of decorative flashing stone that stuck out about a foot, maybe 18 inches, out the side of the museum, went up on an angle to the roof, and here we are climbing up this thing from the second story window up onto the third story roof, and we did our video from up there.
Wow.
The things you do when you're young,
well,
and stupid.
See, and then you climbed up the ladder and got on your roof, and you made up for it.
Yeah, right. You're talking about 3 years ago when
that's
I fell
it.
Off the roof of my house.
That's it.
Broke my back. Was
that's three. That was 3 years ago already. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well,
time flies when you're having fun.
It sure
so
does.
Anyhow, that's pretty much the end of the story of U-505.
Well, we need to find out why it's white, and I also had a question. Was the Enigma machine in the boat when it was captured? Did they all have them?
They all had them, and it was in U-505 when it was captured. Everything was in there, even the code books, everything, because they thought it was going to go down, so everybody just left.
Wow. Do you think it's still in? Did they restore the machine in the boat? Probably not.
No, I think...
Too valuable.
Well, it's not mounted in the boat. It's a unit that comes in, and they put it on its little stand and take it back out. I think... The museum still has that enigma. I'm not sure, though.
Well, you're going to have a very interesting tale to tell when you come back after your Chicago visit. Take the camera. Get a lot of pictures. And you're going to have to fight to keep from talking to these idiots. I get that sense right now.
Most likely. I don't know. I just sent an email this morning to... our member Larry in Chicago, who's arranging all this, and told him to find out if video cameras were allowed. The last time I heard, they were not, because after we did this video, it was a VHS video we did originally. It was that far back in history, and we were selling it to members, copies. The museum sent us a rather harsh letter and said we had to send them 15% of all our sales.
Great people, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 15% of what? We sold maybe 50 of them. Big deal for a multi-zillion dollar operation like the museum. They're talking nickels and dimes.
That's just petty, so petty. You're going to have to sneak a smartphone in there and just click off some pictures, perhaps.
Yeah.
Something. Maybe somebody that goes with you can do it.
First.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking that. And maybe somebody that goes with you can do it. But you'll be able to, you got to get some pictures of the inside. This will be very interesting.
You know.
Say what?
VHLOV.
I know you do. I know.
We'll see.
This will be good. When are you going again? June?
Sometime in June.
Okay. Well, that's a great story. U-505.
Yeah, most people don't. Some people know that that's the most heavily damaged submarine to make it back to its home port.
Uh-huh.
Almost nobody knows about the black market.
Nobody knows any of that.
That was operating. And also, most people still believe that Hans Gobler was the guy who opened the sea strainer when it really was not. It was engineering officer Hauser and... engineering mate Holenried. I've got it in the letter from the chief of the boat. Hans was not well liked with his crewmates. According to him, Captain Lange couldn't make a move unless he checked with Hans. Well, Hans was seaman second class, for Christ's sake. Ridiculous. But he was a hero in his own mind.
Was this boat at one point stored outside in Chicago, or is that another city and another boat?
Oh, no, that was outside Chicago.
So this boat was outside for years.
Mm-hmm. Say again?
This boat was outside for years then.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And when Jack Kahn was the chief at the head of the museum there, he wanted to see how the submarine should be maintained outside, and U-995 is outside in Kiel, Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And my best friend in Germany, Hans-Georg Hess, was the skipper. So I set up a meeting between Jack Kahn and the U-boat veterans over there. So Kahn flew over, and they showed him how to take care of a submarine that was sitting outside. And so U-505 did not succumb to the weather. And then, of course, like I say, it's... they moved it. Where it sat, it was alongside the museum.
Uh-huh.
Then they built an extension wing out across the front of the submarine, and then they built another extension down along the side of the submarine. So now suddenly the submarine is inside of a U of the building, and you couldn't see it from the road or anything. So then they moved it now to its current location inside that bunker-like building.
Very interesting. That bunker looks like it's made of concrete, actually.
It does. I don't know if it really is concrete or what.
The walls. That's a little bit like the pens in France looked.
Similar. similar. We've been in the pens. We had Shark Hunters tours there in 1988, 89, 90.
Wow.
And, yeah, the French Navy has been absolutely super with us when we went over there. But now, from what I understand, the French Navy no longer has control of any of the bunkers except the ones up in Brest. And when we were there last in 1990-ish, they were only using it for their diesel-powered submarines because their Nuki boats were based on an island offshore. And now I think the French Navy no longer uses conventional-powered boats. They're all Nuki boats. So I don't know what they've got going in Brest. They also had their training for mines and mine clearing, but that was a long time ago. The French Navy was super with us. They gave us all sorts of help, gave us run of the place. They even let us take photos when we were at Brest, and one of our guys was taking photos there with our. We had about 40 people in the group, and all of a sudden, the security guy, the gendarme, come running over, blowing on that whistle, and he's yelling at us in French, and our Navy guide pops up and said something else in French and showed him the letter I had from the four-star commanding admiral of the French Atlantic Fleet. Oh, okay.
That took care of that. Very good.
Yeah, the security guy there, the gendarme, he went back to his post shaking his head.
Well, another great Cooper story. Got a million of them, literally. All right, we're going to continue our photo tour with Harry in just a few minutes. Very interesting things coming up next, so stay right there.